So you're ready to start?
Okay, yes. I'll start like I would other oral histories. So my name is Stephanie Bertolotti, and today I am doing a collective oral history interview with Melody Ivins, and we're doing this as a class for Dr. Hall's History 670, right? At the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and today is January 26, 2011. So we got a chance to look at the bio that you sent out, but maybe we could, as a starting place and to kind of set the context, you could talk a little bit more about your family background and any information you wanted to share.
Okay. I tend to talk a lot. If anybody has a question, you know, just wave. I'll pause. Happy to answer questions. I was born in 55 to parents that had both served in the Air Force. When they got married, my mother had to quit because ladies couldn't serve their country in that way. I have two older sibs. I was born in Anchorage, Alaska, which puzzled people when we got to Smithfield when they demanded to know whether I was a Yankee or a rebel. I don't know. My dad's from New Jersey. My mom's from Tennessee. They said, well, where were you born? Alaska. But you'll hear different stories about growing up on military bases. My experience it was a wonderful way to grow up. There were lots of facilities for young families. There were always other kids to play with. The schools were terrific. And there were people from everywhere. People from all over and people of all colors. So even though I grew up in Tennessee and North Carolina, it was on base, which is a tremendously different experience, as I found out. Fifth, sixth, seventh grades in Naples, Italy, which was paradise. NATO was still very strong. American kids were very, very privileged. We got away with murder. We had fabulous schools. And in the year of our Lord, 1968, my father decided to retire and to move us back close to Goldsboro, where we'd been for 5 years, to this little town called Smithfield. I don't know what he was thinking.
Now, we may have some people from Smithfield.
If you're from Smithfield, God bless you, and God has blessed you too. I was in Smithfield long enough to learn to love it and to learn to, I don't know if I could consider myself Southern without that kind of small town experience. But in 1968, at 13, coming from a very different place and being treated like a Martian by people that just didn't know what to make of this Italian girl that talked funny. We were not Italian. Didn't know if she was Yankee or a rebel. Girls didn't speak up in class. Girls did not speak up in class. You can imagine the trouble I got into for that. So I guess it was my third year in Smithfield. I was a sophomore in high school, and the blue jeans revolution came in. And I said, that's for me. The heck with this Peter Pan collars and plaid skirts and your shoes have to match. And Kate Millett appeared on the cover of Time magazine for her book, Sexual Politics. I had never seen a woman on a magazine cover that was there not because she was beautiful. And Kate looked really smart. And like she didn't really care how she looked, and she looked kind of angry. I'm like, and it said women's lib. That's for me. So these were my after trying so hard to accommodate to Smithfield, this was how I adapted. The revolution arrived and I signed right up. My best friend and I were always going to run away and join the revolution somehow, as though you could, you know, go sign up somewhere. They had recruiting offices, but we had just enough sense to take turns chickening out. So I hung in. UNC was the only place I applied to school. My older sister had been here for 2 years. I'd been up to visit and said, that's for me. Chapel Hill, that's for me. And fortunately, they let me in. They had a terrific English department. That was what I wanted to study. And my freshman year, I was fortunate enough to take Jackie, was fall of 73 the first Women in American History course you taught? My first semester here, I was blessed to be in Jackie's class, along with my best friend, who was another Air Force brat. And I'll tell you something I have never told Dr. Hall before.
Uh-oh.
about 2 weeks in, my dear friend and I were not sure if we quite approved of her pedagogy because she was, unlike all of these snotty Harvard doctorates who were so polished and had everything memorized and could wither you with a glance, Dr. Hall was kind of shy and kind of soft-spoken, and she admitted when she didn't know things, and she said, I'll have to check on that. This was an enormous, enormous lecture group. A lot of people wanted to take this class. And we're kind of going, well, you know, she could be a little slicker. She could be a little tougher. By 3 weeks in, when our small group sessions that met after the class kept running overtime because they kept turning into consciousness groups, we all found out over and over we were telling stories we had never told anyone, or things that we hadn't realized were political or were historical or were... we were all completely in love with Dr. Hall, the entire class, and the rest is history.
Wow. This is a shock. I'm going to interrupt and start telling my point of view.
I think that would be wonderful.
Well, the only thing I would say is that I was so scared.
Well, we didn't give you credit for that because you seemed so smart and so polished. It didn't occur to us that this fabulous young woman could also be scared. But again, as soon as we got used to the difference and as soon as we started getting tired of our arrogant male professors, we really liked your style, as well as what you were teaching us.
Maybe my next question would be then, what was the content of, what did you talk about in the consciousness raising groups, and how did that intersect with what was going on in the classroom and outside of the classroom at that particular juncture?
Well, we were studying women in American history, and we were learning about things like the cult of domesticity in the 19th century, and we're going, oh yeah, you know, that was my grandmother's life, that was my mother's life. Oh, these are some of the expectations I was still dealing with coming up, you know, 50 years later. And then current events would come in. North Carolina was trying to pass the ERA that year. Mm-hmm. And the arguments against the ERA were so breathtakingly dumb. People were terrified that that would mean bathrooms, public bathrooms had to be co-ed. Well, you know, that would be the end of the world if public bathrooms were co-ed. That women would lose child custody, that they would lose, money to raise their children after a divorce, and especially that women would be drafted and fight in combat.
Molly, will you just say what the ERA is?
Oh, I'm sorry. The Equal Rights Amendment, which is a very, I think, is it 19 words? That no law shall be abridged on account of sex. Just to put women in the Constitution. And it was a very hard-fought battle. Phyllis Schlafly, the most incredible anti-feminist yet, well, I don't know, she may have some rivals now, made a career of talking about how if this legislation was passed, it would destroy the family, it would destroy femininity. And in North Carolina, we just did fail to pass it, and we were one of the key states that could have approved it and failed to. So we still don't have an Equal Rights Amendment. And I saw recently that Congress is about to debate whether or not women should be allowed in combat roles. I did a paper for Jacqueline way back when because I was interested in the idea of women soldiers that showed women have always fought. Women have fought in every combat you can imagine, sometimes passing as men, sometimes not. It's funny how long legislation sometimes takes to catch up to reality.
So where else were you having these conversations besides the classroom?
With friends, and that would actually go back to high school. Uh-huh. And I was thinking the article, the Van Gogh article for this week. I was impressed to hear someone trying to define the ideology out of which civil rights movement, new left, feminism grew. And I was also tickled because from where I came from, it was so much shaggier than that and less precise. Right. We were not sitting around having study groups on Marcuse, but we were passing around the rare underground newspaper that came into our hands. we were getting a lot of our politics from music. Even in a backwater, music.
Music, oh yes.
Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, they were revolutionary. Country Joe and the Fish were even more revolutionary. This, here we were really, really kind of stranded. Smithfield in so many ways was in the 50s, but contemporary music was getting through. I think it wasn't until I was in Chapel Hill that a copy of Our Bodies, Ourselves came my way. But that was a revolutionary book. That was a book that changed lives. Certainly changed mine. So it was all, it was very amorphous, and people had a little bit of political information, and they had, you know, we shared what we had. We smoked a lot of pot together because that was a revolutionary act. Somehow that was going to end the Vietnam War. And one of the musicians I most admired and wanted to be, Grace Slick of Jefferson Airplane, thought she was going to raise Richard Nixon's consciousness by dropping acid in the punch bowl at the White House. I don't want to imagine Richard Nixon on acid. I'm so glad that didn't work out. But that was very much part of the culture, that by behaving in, by breaking certain laws, by being very unruly and refusing to go along, we were opposing what we saw as what was wrong with the country. Mm-hmm. And we're going to bring it down somehow. So that's some of the background with which I came to Chapel Hill. And pot was even easier to find here. In fact, I managed to quit smoking pot halfway through my freshman year. I had by then done my share of it for life. But
so
it
all
was.
These things you were just talking about are things that were happening in high school.
Yes, ma'am. There was a lot to rebel against in Smithfield. Smithfield was, now what I didn't realize arriving as an eighth grader in 1968, Martin Luther King had just been killed. We were abroad. We didn't know that, you know, half of America caught on fire after that assassination. Bobby Kennedy had just been killed. The Smithfield schools had just integrated. They had just integrated, which we couldn't. This was as bizarre to us as the fact that there were spittoons at the courthouse. You know, that this was normal for them. And I couldn't read the tensions between my fellow students. I didn't know what was wrong. But the arrival of these Martians, you know, these kind of Yankee, kind of Italian people from nowhere, didn't help. Actually, my sister adapted really well and dated a football player, but she was only there a year. The rest of us had to deal with it longer. Anyway, the Klan sign, when you came into Smithfield, was about the size of that wall, and it had a big rearing white horse and the guy in the flowing white robes, and he's holding a burning cross, and it says, help fight communism and integration. They spelled it wrong. And nobody in Smithfield had ever heard of a communist. Nobody had ever met one. But they were so, oh, communism. And then had a little tiny sign hanging off the bottom on a little chain that said, welcome to Smithfield. And the first time I saw it, it was splattered with black paint. People were constantly throwing water balloons full of black paint on it. And the Klan would take it down, oh, across the highway. This is Highway 70 going into Smithfield. You had to go through there on your way to the beach or to Florida. Across the highway was a little bar gas station called the Little Brown Jug that was owned by Klansmen who slept in there at night with their shotguns to protect the sign. So people that were defacing the sign really were placing themselves in danger. And while I was in high school and the Blue Jeans Revolution was well underway, two white male classmates of mine who were sons of some privilege, or they would never have gotten away with this, chopped down the Klan sign. Chopped it down, it was on the ground. The Klan went nuts. The Klan had our newspaper editor, who actually was anti-Klan, was actually fairly progressive, but there was only so much he could do. They insisted he print a story saying that they themselves had taken the sign down in order to.
girl got pregnant, she was kicked out of school. Boy, mm-hmm. went right on. There was no sex education, no information about sex. And so there's this, it is a kind of an amazing, I think, untold story
mm-hmm.
about this moment when students and graduate students, male and female alike, really demanded a kind of openness and knowledge about sex, not with the aim of promiscuity, but with
mm-hmm.
the aim of knowledge and equality, sexual equality between men and women. But this is not a story that is kind of in
mm-hmm.
the literature.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my long-winded, don't ask questions like this in interviews. Lecture the interviewee and tell her about your students.
It was a wonderful, wonderful story, and I'm glad to know about it.
This is a, you know, this is what you call a leading question. But my question being, what kind of narrative would you put forward about the sexual revolution from your experience in the 70s?
Certainly the first narrative you described of women thinking they were being more liberated, in fact they were being exploited, that was a certain amount of that was true. There was a lot of pressure if you were hip, you know, there was no reason not to say yes. And there were men that really took advantage of that. There was date rape then too. Even though we wanted to believe that all guys with long hair were our brothers and, you know, wouldn't do us any harm. There was also the book Our Bodies, Ourselves, which was the first honest, detailed book about sexuality and about health issues that was put out by a women's collective in Boston. It made a tremendous difference in the world. And that talked frankly about sexuality. And I think some of the gay-lesbian liberation movement came directly out of that. People were being more honest. People were talking about their experiences. It was being acknowledged that your desires might not be heterosexual and that was okay. A later development of this would be the porn wars, which Southern Sisters
yes.
opened in the middle of.
Oh, yeah, talk about that and
oh,
how that...
Lord.
How, explain what that was about and then
okay.
how it manifested itself here.
The three women that opened Southern Sisters, the three owners, so the people with the money, and they were 10, 15 years older than me, were ferocious anti-pornography activists. And I really expected their work to a certain extent. They were exploring and documenting that the production of pornography causes harm to women and children. And then pornography is often used to replicate that harm. There are rapists that show up with, you know, a gun and a magazine and put it to a woman's head and say, do this. So Cookie, Bibba, Jane, the owners, this is really their entree into feminism, was they were so furious about the pornography industry and its effects. I was from the circles I traveled in were much more pro-sex. We were beginning to have reservations about all sex all the time actually being good for anybody, but especially for women. But we generally thought, you know, sex was a good thing, and what people did was their own business, and people should have the right, consenting adults should have the right to do as they pleased. And came up just slam. Oh, and the lesbian community. I mentioned the lesbian fiction that was coming out, the lesbian presses at the time. The all-time most popular lesbian press, and I believe it's still going strong, is called Naiad Press, and they do basically lesbian romance novels, which were a great relief from the previous lesbian fiction in which if two women got together, eventually a tree had to fall on one of them and kill her. So these are stories which are more or less realistic, and, you know, and sometimes the women live happily ever after, and then sometimes they don't. But and there's lots of kind of soft core, you know, pretty sex, and these books sell like wildfire. Well, the anti-porn owners at the store did not want us to stock these incredibly popular books, And before the store even opened, we had had this tremendous collision with the majority of the lesbian community in Durham, who were like, "What do you mean you're not going to stock? These are the books we want. You're not going to stock them?" And I was at Southern Sisters a little over 4 years. I spent a lot of the next 4 years fighting with the owners as to what was pornography, because they'd really gotten to the point where they thought the Western canon of art was pornographic. And they're saying, we're not going to have The Joy of Sex on our shelves. We're not going to have this really helpful book for kids, you know, explaining the facts of life. No, we're not going to stop those. They're pornographic. Finally, one of the owners came around on my side, and we managed to stock a few books, and some of our friends in the lesbian community forgave us and came in and bought other books. But it was a huge black mark against the store from the get-go. And nationally, it was one of the most divisive issues feminism has ever faced. People were passionate on one side or the other. And I think I'm kind of late second wave feminism. I think the early third wave, one of the dividing lines is early third wave is pro-sex. We've got Madonna, we've got a certain amount of exhibitionism being said, you know, this is cool. Sexually graphic material is cool. Do me feminism? Anybody remember that? Maybe that was just a media phenomenon. It was weird. They were showing women who were, you know, leaders, academics, feminist leaders were shown, you know, all in glamour shots and in stiletto heels, and somebody or other nicknamed them "Do Me Feminist." This is supposed to be a model for, yes, now we're all going to be, you know, brilliant and fierce and drop dead gorgeous. And love sex all the time. There were some remarkable books that came out around the porn wars that are probably no longer in print. But if anybody's interested, anyone wants to explore it further, be happy to share titles and authors on where to read more. But sexuality can be very, very divisive. I mean, homophobia is now the last respectable prejudice, because it's about sex, and that's scary. And people that don't do it like we do it are weird, you know.
What do you remember about sexual education in your family?
It was non-existent.
Okay.
My mother actually didn't know until her wedding night where babies came from. My sister and I were handed, I don't know what the German equivalent would be, but, and gosh, y'all are probably young enough, you've never had to deal with Kotex, the big fluffy things in the blue box with the flower on the front. but before tampons and before the strips that just stick to your pants, these enormous diapers are what we wore, held on by elastic bands with pieces of shrapnel at the front of them. I mean, this... Be grateful. So Kotex, that were called sanitary napkins, had this nice euphemistic name, and they came out with a little booklet. The cover was the same, little blue with the flower on it, for mothers to give their daughters, so they didn't have to talk to them about menstruation. And women my age have, you know, these stories about being given that book. I know. My mom served spaghetti that night, and I couldn't eat it. My older sister was really concerned about what happened to all those little eggs, all those little babies that didn't get to be babies. She's a sweetie. I'm sure my brothers learned the usual misinformation from their friends, and I learned some misinformation from my brothers. I remember a slumber party when I was maybe 12, 13. The girl we were staying with, her dad was cool and let us look at his Playboy magazines.
Oh.
Ooh, this is what naked grown-up women look like. So we thought we were going to grow up to look like that. And like our Barbie dolls, of course, we'd all played with those, you know. It wasn't very helpful. It was not helpful information. But certainly the attitudes, because when Playboy came out in the 50s, Playboy was hip. Playboy was swinging. This was the way to be cool, was to practice the Playboy philosophy. And without any countervailing female voices, without any women writing or talking about what they found romantic or sexy or provocative, the Playboy philosophy was it. And so girls in the 50s and 60s, that was their education too.
I was thinking that we could talk for a long time. We would get more and more stories. But maybe this is kind of skipping our
we have readings.
I hate to end like this, but what brought an end to the bookstores and to your
Changes in publishing and distribution. The big chains were just coming in.
So when would this have been?
This was like 1991.
Mm-hmm.
The first Barnes & Noble opened between Chapel Hill and Durham. That was a big blow. Nationally, and again, I think we were, some of this was happening in other parts of the country before it arrived here. As the South is traditionally not a good book territory. We don't sell as many, we don't read as many, there aren't as many bookstores. So other places were feeling the effects first. We had a little warning that that was coming. But also the store kind of imploded. The owners, my version of the story is the owners decided that since I was doing all the work, that everything that was going wrong was my fault. And they cut my wages in half. And promoted my assistant, who was a little more malleable, cooperative. And I continued to work my 60-hour weeks for 20-hour week pay for several months, and finally realized I just couldn't do it anymore. That store was my mission. That store had to work. That store couldn't do without me. I knew that. And sure enough, it closed within 6 months of my departure. I think that's when they found out how much I was doing. And I think the owners also got tired of it. Again, without me there, they actually had to do something.
So much for a romantic view of sisterhood.
it was a terrible education in feminists behaving in very unfeminist ways.
You talked a lot about people who are like inside the movement, definitely would consider themselves part of the movement. I was wondering if you could talk about people who were kind of on the periphery, or people who wouldn't have said they were part of any movement but still shared similar views, kind of how those people interacted as part of you know, this larger movement of movements that we've been reading about and talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know from the perspective of being a librarian and then a bookseller, so we had resources people needed.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my favorite customers would not have described themselves as feminist, although they were sympathetic.
Yeah.
The solid waste manager of Durham, Greg Bethea, magnificent African-American man, loved our books on ecology and would come in and read those and talk with us. And any number of people that simply wanted the information that we had to offer were sympathetic to the movement, did not consider themselves movement people, but they were fabulous supporters. And we had material on material for AIDS survivors before the gay bookstore in Raleigh did. The people distributing that material said, "Will you stock this so we can make the guys in Raleigh stock?" And I said, "Sure." And it worked. So, you know, the gay men were our allies. Some of them were feminists, some of them were not. There was the overlap of movements that wove in and out of the feminist movement, where there were people doing work on Latin America, Africa, you know, global economy, peace movement, a lot of peace movement activism.